effort to expand its reach to Hebrew-speaking audiences around the world. Hello and welcome everyone, your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has issued a statement strongly condemning Israel's savage assassination of senior Hezbollah commander Haitham Ali al-Tabtaba'i. The IRGC stressed that the regime's cowardly terrorist act during the so-called ceasefire is not a show of strength, but proof to its weakness and desperation. The statement expressed deep regret over the silence and inaction of international and human rights institutions on Israel's genocide and savage actions, and Washington's support for the regime. It emphasized that, contrary to what the U.S., Israel, and their criminal allies dream of, the resistance remains alive and dynamic. The IRGC stressed that the resistance axis and Hezbollah reserve the right to avenge their fighters and commanders in due time with a crushing response that the terrorist aggressor regime will not expect. The Hamas resistance movement has called on international courts to prosecute those behind the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation for committing crimes against the Palestinian people. Hamas made the call after the American organization announced the end of its operations in Gaza. Hamas said that GHF contributed to the daily massacres of starving Palestinians and those seeking aid. It added that the foundation and those responsible for it must be held accountable for their crimes to prevent the recurrence of such tragedies and protect humanity from organized international terrorism. The movement asserted that since its entry into Gaza, the foundation acted as part of the occupying regime's security apparatus. It said that GHF used aid distribution methods that had no relation to humanitarian work and created degrading conditions for civilians trying to access food. Hamas stressed that the foundation's methods resulted in thousands of deaths and injuries due to sniper fire and deliberate killings, making complicit in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling joined us earlier to share his insights on the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and its complicity in the Gaza genocide. Let's take a listen.
At last, we see the back of this foundation. I think it's interesting that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation uses this kind of charitable status as many other organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation. These people are very much like what we have in the UK, trusts. And the idea is that they're a charitable organization. They're not for profit. But in this case, they're for killing. I'd just like to point out that there are 2,600 dead and injured people who were trying to access the Gaza so-called Humanitarian Foundation's facilities, which had been forced to take over because the Israelis, the Americans and the British and everybody else supporting the genocide was preventing UNRWA from doing their job, the United Nations, that is. And so, thankfully, this organisation is no more. One of their leaders, John Acree, I noticed, he was saying that what a wonderful job we did. He denied that any had been killed, so 2,600 dead and injured. He just was looking the other way. He didn't notice it. And actually, there were snipers, as you said, were actually killing people as they came towards the aid. So it was almost like a killing trap that you might set for a rat or an animal. That's what the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was, and so it's good to see the back of it.
Well, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has expressed deep concern over the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, saying the territory's situation remains catastrophic despite the ceasefire. UNRWA said more than 90% of Gaza's population is entirely dependent on aid, with many people receiving only one meal every 24 hours. The agency stressed that despite the truce agreement, only an average of 170 trucks enter Gaza daily, which is far below the minimum required to meet basic needs. It noted that Gaza's clinics receive 15,000 patients daily, with malnutrition and its complications accounting for up to 99% of cases. Arnawa said more than 80,000 displaced people who have lost their homes during the Israeli genocide are still using UN-run shelters. On the education front, Arnawa said some 44,000 children in Gaza are receiving their education in difficult circumstances within temporary learning spaces located in nearly 60 shelters. Palestinian towns and refugee camps in the occupied West Bank witness more deaths and destruction as Israeli forces press ahead with their daily raids. In one of the latest incidents, a Palestinian young man was killed in an attack by the regime's forces in Nablus. The new fatality came after earlier in the day, a Palestinian youth was killed after being shot by Israeli forces in a raid on a village of Deir Jarir, northeast of Ramallah. Another Palestinian young man from the city of Dura, south of Al-Khalil, was also killed after being brutally beaten by the regime's forces. Israeli forces also raided the towns of Hanin and Meithalum, west and south of Jenin, respectively. According to local sources, Israeli forces attacked Hanin, deployed troops on its streets, abducted several young men, and confiscated surveillance cameras and several commercial shops. Our West Bank correspondent Akal Hamad joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel atrocities across the occupied territory. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
Unfortunately, it's going to be a long night for both Nablus and Jenin cities as the Israeli forces are making incursions to both of the cities now at this moment. Let's start from Nablus, where a prior incursion was made by the Israeli forces towards Nablus city. The special forces, Al-Yamam battalion, have infiltrated into Nablus city, attacking a Palestinian. Until now, there is no confirmation from a Palestinian source, nor did the Israeli sources have announced the name of that young man. In the western area, another home was besieged by the Israeli forces, which means that the IOF besieged Nablus from the eastern side and from the western side, performing a military operation inside Nablus. In the western side, arrests have been made from Mohammed al-Shafi'i and Samer al-Sidda. Samer al-Sidda is a liberated Palestinian prisoner, and he was re-detained tonight, and the PRCF announced that there has been an injury during this raid beside the Palestinian who was killed, which, by the way, the PRCS was banned from reaching to the site of this assassination.
Israel has intensified its settlement expansion activities in the occupied West Bank town of Beit Omar in recent days. As a result, more land has been bulldozed and Palestinian farmers' access to their farmland has been restricted. Palestinians say these measures are part of a broader effort to push them out of their homes. Our correspondent Tiba Asse reports.
Bulldozers have leveled large areas of land in the town of Beit Omar near Al-Khalil over the past days. The activity is said to be part of efforts to expand the Karmit Sur settlement from the western side. At the same time, expansion work is also progressing from the eastern side toward the Rosh Atzion settlement. The activities have left Beit Omar trapped between the two settlement areas.
Beit Omar in the northern district of Al-Khalil has long been a center of Palestinian resistance. The town faces repeated land confiscations, military raids, and strict restrictions on farmland, forcing residents to struggle daily to protect their homes, land, and livelihoods.
Abu Maria rejected the Israeli claim of security reasons for its actions in Beit Omar, seeing it as a pretext to justify settlement expansion. Farmers have been particularly affected. Israel has designated their farmland as closed military zones, uprooting trees and restricting access to surrounding areas.
What's happening here has deeply affected us. I've been farming this land for many years, and now the Israeli regime is bulldozing and damaging parts of it without any real reason. They claim it's for security, but that's not true. The goal is clear: expanding settlements at the expense of our land.
These lands are a source of livelihood for many families here. Blocking Palestinians from accessing them has nothing to do with security.
It's a way to take over the area and push people out.
In addition to settlement expansion, Palestinians' livelihoods in the occupied West Bank are also threatened by settler attacks. Such incidents have increased in recent years, with many blaming Israeli officials for turning a blind eye to the violence.
As Israeli forces keep bulldozing and leveling Palestinian infrastructure and land, residents here say this is part of the regime's wider plot, not only to seize more land, but also to escalate settler violence in the area, piling up pressure on the local community and restricting their access to what remains of their farmland. Tiba Asi, Occupied West Bank.
Well, Press TV has officially launched its Hebrew language news service in order to expand its reach to Hebrew-speaking audiences worldwide. A dedicated website for the service is expected to be launched soon to provide audiences with direct access to the relevant content. It will deliver a mix of news, analysis, and commentaries covering both regional and international developments. The service has already gone live on X social media platform. A Telegram channel has been also launched to offer followers another outlet to receive updates. The move followed a directive issued by Iran's Supreme Council of the Culture Revolution in early November. It tasked the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting with establishing an international television network in Hebrew. According to Article 2 of the directive, the project is intended to strengthen Iran's media diplomacy, counter hostile narratives, and provide a more accurate account of regional developments. Well, in Tehran, a vast funeral procession has carried the remains of 100 unknown soldiers from Iran's 8-year sacred defense to their final resting place, coinciding with the martyrdom anniversary of Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, Gisoo Misha Ahmadi reports.
The streets of Tehran turning into rivers of remembrance. Coffins draped in flowers and the Iranian tricolor moving slowly from the main gate of Tehran University along major avenues towards the martyrs' memorial. Thousands lining the route, reciting prayers and chanting tributes for the fallen. The ceremony marking National Day of Unknown Soldiers honors fighters whose remains were recovered decades after the Iraqi-imposed war. Their sacrifice, officials say, remains the backbone of Iran's security.
You should not think they have died. According to Islamic teaching, they are alive with God. We are here to let these unknown soldiers know we remember them and are grateful for their sacrifice.
Among the crowd are veterans, families of martyrs, school children, and young volunteers, generations connected through shared memory and devotion to their homeland.
They sacrificed their lives for our homeland. That is the ultimate act of faith and love for the nation.
The unity of the people is what the martyrs expect from us, not distraction or division.
We are just like their families. We are here for them. I lost my own family, all martyred in the war, so I feel like a sister, a mother, to these unknown martyrs.
While huge crowds escort 100 martyrs to their final resting place, even more have converged on Imam Hussein Square for a special ritual marking the martyrdom anniversary of Lady Fatima Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet of Islam. Here, massive cauldrons of samanu, a sweet paste made from wheat germ, are stirred in turn by volunteers. This is more than a religious ritual. It is an act that fosters empathy and solidarity.
Everyone you see here has come out of love for our beloved lady. Honoring martyrs is rooted in our culture, a tradition that never fades.
Two scenes, one spirit. Iran's culture of remembrance, transforming grief into faith. From Samanu offerings in Imam Hussein Square to salutes before the coffins of the unknown soldiers.
As Iranians bid farewell to these unknown martyrs, the participants say the sacrifice of these fallen soldiers is the foundation of Iran's unity, resilience, and security. Gisoo Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
In other news, the U.S. Defense Department says it is launching a probe against a high-profile Democratic senator who recently clashed with President Donald Trump over vague allegations of misconduct. The Pentagon has even threatened to recall Mark Kelly, a retired Navy captain, to active duty status in order to prosecute him. Senator Kelly is part of a bloc of lawmakers who recently broadcast a critical video directly challenging the U.S. administration by urging military personnel to uphold their oath over political obedience. In that video, he said the Trump administration is pitting uniformed military and intelligence committee professionals against American citizens, and they can refuse to obey illegal orders. The Pentagon did not specify the nature of allegations against Kelly, but said all service members have a legal obligation to obey lawful orders. Trump also already shown a violent reaction to the video, describing the lawmakers' action as seditious behavior punishable by death. Senator Kelly defied threats against him and other senators, stressing that he will not be intimidated and will not stop during his job, including oversight of the executive branch. Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of Israel's criminal behavior and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be setting out the real reasons behind Israel's renewed interest in Somaliland. In our first report, Rajiv Ravichakra provides some historical context to the recent developments in the relationship between Somaliland and Israel.
When people mention Greater Israel, they usually mean the plan to colonize all of what the Zionists call Erez Yisrael. That is, all the land between the rivers Nile and Euphrates, and thus includes all of Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan, and parts of Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Egypt. But it is increasingly recognized that the Greater Israel project has aims far beyond West Asia. This has been admitted by Netanyahu, who says he absolutely subscribed to the vision. He has even presented maps of the new Middle East, which include all of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, as well as Sudan. But plans are much further advanced than this suggests. Somaliland is one of the Zionists' targets. It's a country which the Zionist movement wants to turn into a military base from which the Zionists and the UAE carve up Africa into easily manipulated resource plundering zones. Crucially, it is also very close, around 150 nautical miles, to the coast of Yemen, where the Zionists seek to destroy the Ansar Allah government. Somaliland is a former British colony bordering Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Somalia that declared independence from Somalia in 1991 without receiving international recognition. Under international law, Somaliland is currently deemed an autonomous district of Somalia. In 1960, a time when Somaliland was briefly independent, Israel was one of the 35 countries to recognize its independence. Back in the 1990s, the self-styled president of the so-called Republic of Somaliland wrote to the Zionist regime, asking for help with overcoming the Islamist adversaries of the people of Somaliland. "My government needs the support and assistance of the State of Israel to defend our nascent state from the menace of pro-Islamist dark forces." In February 2010, Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesperson Yigal Palmor revealed that Netanyahu was prepared to recognize Somaliland again. Though, it did not happen at the time. The plans are now active again. In late 2024, reports emerged that Israel had secretly approached Somaliland with an offer to establish a military base on its territory in exchange for official recognition. Somaliland is reportedly willing to accept the Israeli base, provided that Israel recognizes Somaliland and invests in it. In October this year, the Zionist regime dispatched Miss Israel on a mission to supposedly save Somali children, claiming in manifest propaganda that they were providing aid and protection without requesting anything in return. The neighboring Sudanese government's view is that Somaliland now serves as a UAE military hub. Armored vehicles, weapons, and gear flow through, moving onward to Ethiopia and into Darfur, fueling the RSF and UAE-backed mercenaries. Somaliland is on fire, not despite, but because of the intervention of the Zionists and their UAE proxies.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyum University. Today's guest contributor is a good friend of the show. He's the political commentator, celebrated hip-hop artist, and regular correspondent for Double Down News. His name is Loki. Welcome to the show. David, the Zionist ambition for a greater Israel is much larger than many people think, isn't it?
Well, you saw in the film there, didn't you, the extent of greater Israel in the original Zionist plans, which of course had been denied for many decades, but now everybody acknowledges that they're true, including, of course, Netanyahu. And then you saw the Netanyahu at the UN with his diagrams of the new Middle East, which of course extends way beyond the greater Israel. But of course we see in Somaliland and in Sudan and indeed in Ethiopia the extent of the attempts by the Zionists to get into Africa and to use Africa as a mechanism for military projection and also, of course, for resource extraction. So, yeah, of course, they are trying to move way beyond the question of a greater Israel in West Asia, into Africa, into East Asia, and even into Latin America as well.
Well, Loki, I mean, how far do you think the ambition for a greater Israel extends then?
I think it depends on the definition that you apply. Because if you're talking about infrastructurally speaking, then in this country, for example, the police hacks phones with the use of an Israeli intelligence company, which has access to that information. You have Oracle managing the data for key government institutions, and that organization clearly has a commitment to Israel, works closely with the Israeli military, and has a leader who is the largest donor to the Israeli military in the history of the charity that manages those donations. So really it spreads across the world in different ways, and I would say it exists within the infrastructural arrangements of society, meaning access to data, access to information. If you've just had the former head of Israel's external intelligence agency saying they have exported manipulated equipment into all sorts of countries, then you're really talking about something quite different from what is sometimes depicted as a colonial settler movement specifically focused on Palestine. You are now talking about something that has established itself as a regional hegemon militarily, certainly, but now also this interesting role around the world of trying to dictate events, control information, and bully governments.
Are we looking to a worldwide hegemon then? I mean, we've talked about a regional one, but I mean, from what you're saying, it seems to be obviously considerably
worldwide. Well, what certainly is true is that the United States has around 1,000 military bases around the world. What we don't know is the extent to which the Israeli military either has access to those bases or a presence on those bases. It's certainly come alongside the US empire around the world, but we just don't know the extent of Israel's role in these places.
Sure. Well, David, I mean, how long has the Zionists' involvement in Somaliland been going on for?
Well, we saw in the film there, I mean, they were involved way back when Somaliland declared itself independent. 35 countries in the world recognized it back in 1960, and the Zionists were one of those. And then more recently, they've opened these new negotiations to create a base there. alongside their vassal state, the UAE, so that they can use the Somaliland's territory as a means for power protection in the region of the Horn of Africa, including the Sudan and Ethiopia and other countries in the area. So it's they've been involved for a long time, but they've now got focused and renewed efforts to extend their ability to project power into Africa. But of course, let's remember that the other reason why they want to be on the Red Sea and Horn of Africa coast is because it's just across the water from Yemen and from Ansarallah. 140 miles is the closest distance from Somaliland to the port of Aden. And of course, that's part of the agenda as well.
Yeah, so it's kind of a military strategic.
It's a military strategic in terms of West Asia and Yemen, but it's military strategic in a different way in terms of power projection into Africa, into Sudan, and indeed further afield across to West Africa.
Sure. Well, Loki, I mean, Somaliland, I mean, it's not recognised as a country, is it, by the international community? So, I mean, what do you think Israel's moving to recognise? Is it? I mean, David was just alluding to the situation in terms of its proximity to Yemen. I mean, is it to do with Ansarallah and their ability to, you know, to strike back against Ansarallah, or what?
Well, if you look at it historically, the UAE from 2017 has controlled the port there. It also has a military base there, which has been accused of aiding in different ways forces within Sudan and being a basis of operations. The UAE has a network of airfields and bases across the region. And you also have to remember that the port of the Somaliland is controlled by DP World. Now, DP World is headed by a UAE government official who emails have just been released, was discussing the use of smart shoes with Jeffrey Epstein, the now deceased, it appears, Israeli asset. Mm. So essentially Israel wants to establish a military presence in Somaliland. It may have already done that through the UAE. That's probably the case. The Abraham Accords was about regional integration economically and militarily. It was about getting money from the Gulf to flow into the Zionist entity, but also the militaries in the region to become openly integrated and working together. And that was, you know, one of the key stipulations of the Abraham Accords is that the countries which sign on to it have to invest. I mean, in the cases of some of the Gulf countries, it looks like about $10 billion in the Israeli economy over many, many years. Now, that's pretty incredible. Mm. What would be the kind of stipulations placed on a tiny mini state like Somaliland? Mm. So really, the Abraham Accords has been a subterfuge through which this empire that we're talking about has been expanded and extended, and Somaliland would be no different.
Right, okay. Well, so, I mean, David, I mean, it seems, doesn't it? It certainly looks as if that, you know, the Zionist entity and the UAE, I mean, they're using Somaliland as a sort of a gateway into Africa.
Look, it's a gateway into Africa. As I've said, it's about power projection, military power projection, both ways, back to West Asia and Yemen, into the rest of Africa. But it's also about resource extraction. So as we saw in the show the other week about Sudan, the UAE has been involved in smuggling gold out of the Sudan. And, of course, that's part of that's going through Ethiopia, through Somaliland, and then up to the UAE. So, and clearly the Zionists are involved in that. We've previously done shows on the extraction of diamonds from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Israel is one of the biggest exporters of diamonds, doesn't produce any diamonds itself. So it's about resource extraction, but it's also about the sinews of a proto-empire coming together. So we did a show just the other week on Taiwan. Now, the Taiwanese have a big presence in Somaliland, and that's about integrating resource extraction into the semiconductor industry in Taiwan, which, of course, has been benefited from by Israeli companies who have contracts there. So it's a quite a complex emergent empire which is coming about there.
Mm. And you also have to remember that Somaliland, for example, is a rich source of gemstones, the emeralds, rubies, also a rich source of lithium, which is vitally important to the big tech world, and Israel is a major player there.
Yes, indeed. I mean, David's saying they're, you know, incredibly complex and certainly tangled sort of web, low-key. But, I mean, the UAE, appears to be using Somaliland as a bridge to Ethiopia, doesn't it? And onto its, indeed, its involvement in the massacres in Sudan.
Well, if you look across the region, and satellite imaging has revealed the extent of UAE construction in the region, a literal network of bases around the Bab el-Mandeb and around the Red Sea. Socotra, for example, which it's believed Israeli presence is there too, very, very close, and a good vantage point through which to hit the Yemeni forces. So the UAE has been accused of supplying the RSF in Sudan through all of these bases in the area. And it is really, would be in line with history to see Israel having a direct role with the UAE on those bases, probably aiding the war in Sudan. You also have to remember why Sudan is so important. Because historically, you had an underground base there, which was discovered. And the allegation was is that the underground base existed for the sole purpose of aiding the resistance in Gaza. Mm. So there was weapons manufacturing happening under the ground in Sudan, which was then going up, going through Egypt, and then going into Gaza. That is what the allegation is. Mm. Now, if that is the case, then you can very clearly see how important strategically Sudan is to the continuation, really, of Zionism in Gaza alone, let alone the rest of the region.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I'm afraid our next report now highlights the catalogue of aggressive actions of the Zionist regime against nations bordering the Red Sea and the Horn of Africa.
The countries bordering the Red Sea and the Horn of Africa have all been under assault by the Zionist regime. In 1986, the Mossad embarked on a secret mission to bring Ethiopian Jews to Israel via Djibouti, but things went terribly wrong. Today, Djibouti is opposed to normalization with Zionism and to the genocide. It now hosts the only Chinese overseas base in the hemisphere. Zionist-Eritrean cooperation dates back to the mid-1990s. The Zionist regime has established a military base on the Dahlak Archipelago, 43 kilometers from the Eritrean coast. The second largest naval base outside its borders and one of the most advanced intelligence centers in the Horn of Africa, overlooking the Red Sea. Surveillance towers on top of the island's mountains are used by the Zionist Air Force for targeting. Israel has launched operations on Sudan from here. In recent years, however, Eritrea has reportedly pivoted towards Russia, China, and Iran. Israel and Ethiopia maintain close security relations. In November 2020, the Ethiopian National Intelligence and Security Service signed an agreement with Mossad to enhance intelligence and counterterrorism cooperation. In 2021, in a joint operation, 16 suspects were arrested in Addis Ababa, planning attacks on UAE embassies in Ethiopia and Sudan. Military cooperation has expanded in recent years, with the provision of military support, training, and equipment to Ethiopia. Ethiopia recently signed an agreement with Somaliland to lease a naval base in the port of Berbera. Socotra is a small archipelago of islands just off the coast of Yemen, which the UAE invaded and occupied in 2018. Recent reports suggest an Israeli desire to build a military and intelligence facility there. Construction is reportedly already underway on Abd al-Kuri Island, part of Socotra, where a port, runway, and helicopter landing pad have been built. The UAE is not just a totalitarian state, but part of a new imperial axis with the Zionist state. This UAE-Israel axis sometimes acts as a satellite of U.S. power, but now also pursues its own expansionist interests. As in Socotra, or power projection bases such as South Sudan and Somaliland. The ideological base of the UAE-Israel axis is Zionist Islamophobia, combined with totalitarian hyper-neoliberalism. This ideology is in accord with U.S. imperial interests. But the UAE-Israel axis does not trust the U.S. and seeks independence from it, hence the debate on the Zionist right about whether the State of Israel should continue to accept U.S. aid. part of the reason some anti-imperialists still cling to outdated ideas of the Zionist project and Persian Gulf states as simple U.S. satellites is this major blind spot about the importance of the UAE-Israel relationship and how its black ops are changing the world around us, from Europe to Africa to India.
Well, David, I mean, Djibouti and Eritrea have a long experience, don't they, of Zionist involvement in their countries?
Yeah, I mean, the Djibouti example is a nice one, isn't it? Because there was a Mossad operation there. They were trying to smuggle out and kidnap Ethiopian Jews to bring them to the colony to be settlers sure. there to challenge their demographic problem. And, of course, it all went wrong, and several of them were killed. There was all sorts of attacks on them. And part, I think that's led to the way in which Djibouti now orients such that it's got the first and only Chinese base in the hemisphere. I think, in fact, the only Chinese military base outside China in Djibouti. And the same really looks to be happening potentially in Eritrea since 2020. Although there's that base, it's really based there. The Eritreans have turned against the Zionist entity. They've even severed diplomatic relations. They've made statements about the genocide. So it's looking like there's a kind of pushback, and that's the sign that there can be pushback against the Zionist overreach in the region.
Yeah. I mean, locally, in the first segment, we talked, didn't we, about the UAE's involvement with Ethiopia. But, I mean, Ethiopia's developed close relations with the Zionist entity as well, hasn't it?
Well, it's not so much a question of developing close relations, it's those close relations have almost always existed.
Right.
Ethiopia, around 200,000 Ethiopians are Israeli citizens, at least. Many of them serve currently in the Israeli military. We know that there were three coup attempts which were foiled by Israeli intelligence against Emperor Haile Selassie back in the day. You also have the case of Israel being able to establish in Ethiopia an Ethiopian company by the name of Encoda, which was exporting meat around the region, but actually was an Israeli intelligence operation.
Right.
Of course, the arrangements have come with Israel training the Ethiopian special forces, the military, the police, the security around the political leaders. So really there is a very, very close and integrated relationship between Ethiopia and Israel.
Right. Yeah, David, in the first segment, you started to touch on resource extraction. And I just wondered if you might say a little bit more, really, about the Zionist entity and the UAE's involvement in the Horn of Africa. It's predominantly about resource extraction. I mean, just say a bit more.
It's about all of these things, isn't it? It's about power projection, both back into West Asia and Yemen, into the Horn of Africa and indeed beyond that. But also, as Loki was saying, the existence of gems and especially lithium, which of course is important for the tech industry and in particular for the semiconductor industry, which of course Taiwan is one of the world leaders in. This indicates the kind of close circle of all this.
So yes,
of course, it's about military projection, but it's also about the resources which they can use to enhance power projection around the world, which of course includes the semiconductors and the cybersecurity industry and all of that. So it's both of those
it's
things.
It's been about the sort of resource extraction and the sort of military.
It's a kind of it's the traditional imperialist or colonial relationship. There are military questions and there are economic questions.
It's following the pattern. Yeah, sure. Well, Loki, I mean, this military base then that the Zionists are building in UAE occupied Yemen. I mean, that's a worrying development, isn't it?
Well, I mean, of course, the situation is such that everybody that has stood up for Palestine in a meaningful way, and Israel Katz said this, the Israeli war minister, they will pay a price. And their argument is that, at the very least, any of those forces should be currently fighting for survival rather than being able to flourish. Not only endure the war, but move past it and move on. So without a doubt, Yemen is likely to be the target of a savage campaign soon. However, the Trump vision, and this is very clear in the International Stabilization Force that he's trying to introduce in Gaza, is actually to get the Muslim majority nations to carry out Israel's objectives. So when they're trying to send in a force into Gaza to disarm the Palestinian resistance, they're trying to send in the Indonesian military, the Malaysian military, and I think there's a question here of whether Israel trusts Turkey enough to be part of that international stabilization force. And so, you know, you look at the military plane crash in the last few days of a Turkish plane in which 20 people were killed, a plane dissolving in midair almost, taking off from Azerbaijan, then serious questions have to be asked about whether that was a warning sent to the Turkish government.
I think it's also important to stress, isn't it, that it's the, you know, it's the deals being done with the political elites in those countries, not the people, is it?
Well, that's a fact. That's absolutely.
So, I mean, I think it's important that we do stress that. But to David, I mean, are the UAE and the Zionists then, I mean, cooperating in their operations in the Horn of Africa?
Self-evidently they are. I mean, in Socotra, which the UAE illegally occupied in 2018, the Israelis appear to be building a base there. It's not very clear whether the base will be for IOF operations or for UAE operations. And indeed, as Loki was saying, in the port in Somaliland, which the Somalis, Somaliland administration offered to Ethiopia, they signed a contract with it. This is run by people from the UAE, and there's also the question of whether the Zionists already have some kind of presence there and whether they're able to build their own base there. It's perfectly plain that there are, there is very, very close collaboration. The UAE is a vassal state of the Zionists. It's been devoted to pursuing Zionist interests in West Asia and indeed in the UK and the US for many years now. So you would expect that.
And final word, we've only got about 30 seconds left at Loki. But what do you think we should make of this very extensive Zionist involvement in the Horn of Africa, if you can sum that up in 20 seconds?
Well, what I would say is that AFRICOM is moving across the continent of Africa every single day, and it's very likely that Israel is plugged into that, you know, Project 2025, Ted Cruz push against, you know, places like Djibouti to try and push back against China in Africa. That will definitely come with direct Israeli involvement also.
Right, okay. Well, we could clearly have done with a bit more time today, but I'm afraid that's all we have got time for. So I'd like to thank our guest, Loki, and make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller here with more revelations and information that you won't find in the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. Shouts and shakes. but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, protecting the women. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Trade with me, Sister Zainab. And look, the topic of protecting the women, so this is something very special in Islam, that obviously we should be giving special consideration to women, because obviously Islam recognizes that women have a nature that is different to that of men. So women are sort of made more sort of emotional, more sensitive, and this is actually a strength that actually complements the sort of different nature of men. And that means that obviously behavior towards women should actually be different in some situations than it would be towards men. And obviously we know that obviously the Holy Prophets said, you know, if we're sort of asked, you know, who do we consider first? It's always, you know, the mother, before even the father, for example. In particular sort of situations, what does this mean? And I just want to refer to something from life of one of the famous martyrs of the whole defense by the name of Said Can Bozorgi. So this is a very specific context. So he had a very difficult operation to face because he had serious injuries from the holy defense. Now he did not tell his mother or his wife what the precise reason for this operation was. So he gave them one reason. He said it was for such and such, but he didn't give them the actual reason. So he just said that there was some sort of shrapnel or something. In fact, there was actually a tumor. So he didn't tell the female members of his family. And obviously, so why did he do that? That is because he knew. So obviously, especially the mother would have been in tremendous sort of worry about her son, and as would his wife would have been in tremendous worry for her husband. Welcome back to A to Z here on Iron Ridge Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and I'm talking about a particular situation, a context in which we sort of protect women. In the case of the martyr Said Can Bozorgi, I've just mentioned, did not inform his mother or his wife of the seriousness of the operation he was about to undergo. And, you know, maybe in your own lives you've actually witnessed something like this, and it might even go beyond even protecting the women. Some of you might have even sort of kept a particular operation or illness or something from other people so as not to, let's say, worry them. This doesn't necessarily have to be the most serious sort of illness operation. It could even be maybe you have the flu or something else, and you know, you sort of keep it to yourself. Maybe, you know, maybe you're not, let's say, next to your parents. Maybe the parents don't live in the same town. And maybe when you're speaking with your parents, or let's say especially your mother, you don't tell your mother that, you know, you're that this is a very serious flu, or that maybe a couple of years back at least that you got COVID, because you don't want to cause undue worry, not to your father and especially not to your mother. So, you know, you keep it to yourself unless it really gets to that level where you have to, because it's extremely serious. And I wouldn't be surprised if many of us actually have little stories like that to tell. And, you know, again, I very well remember one neighbour who ultimately died of cancer. And she did not say a thing to anyone. We only found out what had happened was when she'd actually died. And, you know, and she had just been beautifully friendly, and no one knew, basically. But she was going through all this on her own, and probably not even sort of informing many of her friends, so, and maybe also just not wanting to cause undue worry, because some people, you know, we just don't want to cause stress to others. We don't want them to worry. And obviously, yes, protecting the women. So let's see if we can just bear that in mind and see if we can, in our daily lives, just always remember that we should be treating the women just a little bit differently and just have a little bit more consideration, inshallah. So that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on I'm Being English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Journey into the unknown, from West Asia to Turkey, to the Greek islands, hoping to reach Europe illegally. It is considered one of the stories of illegal immigration faced by many refugees and migrants. This journey often starts from West Asia to the Turkish coast of Izmir, which is a departure point for many people trying to reach Europe, especially across the Aegean Sea, in an attempt to reach the Greek islands. Young Palestinian from Gaza. His story is part of the tragedy lived by the people of Gaza. It reflects the level of despair felt by these young men, despite their attachment to their land and their right to it. However, some see that seeking refuge in Europe is a temporary solution to financially support their families in Gaza and help them endure. Amir risks his life on an illegal journey, hoping to return one day to his occupied homeland under better conditions than today.
I traveled to help my family because of the recent war on Gaza. We lost our lands and our home, and my father and my fiancé were martyred. I traveled to support them, but after everything I witnessed here and the illness we suffered, we gained nothing. We'll return to Gaza after what I have seen here. I will take the residency and go back to Gaza because it is my homeland and I will never abandon it. I will not leave it to the Israelis.
Gaza Strip has been under siege for years, and now it is experiencing genocide, forcing people to leave their land, but they refuse to do so and cling to their land despite the deteriorating economic situation, increasing unemployment rates, and lack of educational and professional opportunities. The residents also suffer from a severe shortage of basic resources, such as electricity and water, in addition to the continuous destruction of infrastructure due to armed conflicts and ongoing wars. The people of Gaza face enormous challenges in building their future within the Strip and need support to continue resisting.
I traveled from Gaza alone on a visa to Turkey, then from there to Egypt, and later back to Turkey. I got in touch with a smuggler there, and we set off across the sea 8 times. We saw death with our own eyes until we reached Greece, hoping to live with dignity, but we regretted arriving there. No one understands the suffering of traveling by boat except those who have gone through it. No matter how much I describe it, no one will feel what we went through. Many died at sea because of the Greek Coast Guard, who would shoot at us, take our phones and money, and send us back to the sea mercilessly.
Psychological distress that we see is really high. You have people crying, people shaking, people decompensating as well sometimes. And again, it's always linked to the fear of violence, the fear of being pushed back, the fear of being exposed again to not knowing what will happen, and most often to violence. So there is really those two components in this activity, the medical care, but as well the psychological care.
Israeli colonization of Palestine is the problem of West Asia. But the United States and the European Union have provided significant political, military, and financial support to Israel for decades. This support has contributed to solidifying Israel's military superiority and the continuation of its occupation of Palestinian territories. The United States, in particular, is considered Israel's biggest ally, providing billions of dollars annually in military aid and repeatedly using the veto power in the UN Security Council to prevent resolutions condemning Israeli policies. The European Union presents a more balanced stance on the surface, but practically it also supports Israel through trade agreements and strong diplomatic relations, with timid positions on the ongoing violations of Palestinian rights. Many believe that this support encourages Israel to continue its policies of occupation, settlement, and blockade, without fear of international accountability.
Very interestingly, and actually it shows how what's happening in Greece in terms of migration is linked to the broader picture and what happened outside. People from Gaza were actually one of, or the first community of people arriving in Greece before the 7th of October. People arrive in Europe, in Greece, indeed with a lot of traumatic experience. A lot of violence happened to them from country of origin to the transit country, to sometimes as well when just crossing the sea from Turkey to Greece. We provide psychological care. We have a few psychologists, and they either provide group session, but also individual session, trying to relieve the suffering of those invisible wounds.
Many humanitarian organizations provide support to migrants on these islands, but the problem persists as it needs radical solutions at the level of European countries and international cooperation. The most important of these solutions is addressing the root causes of migration and developing comprehensive migration policies. The European Union has not provided significant support to Greece to help it face